This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
How did we get into the position of trying to persuade city-dwelling humans we still need nature? And how can we describe the speed at which life is disappearing? All that is in a stunning new report from the United Nations. Dr. Sandra Diaz is the lead author of this report that is taking the world by storm. It is the IPBES Global Assessment Report on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. That is where we discover ongoing human damage to other living things is as great a threat as climate change. The scientific work of Sandra Diaz is decorated with many awards. She is one of the most cited environmental scientists in the world with over 300 peer-reviewed papers. Diaz works from the University of Cordoba in Argentina, her home base. From Cordoba, Sandra Diaz, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. Pleasure to be talking to you.
Yes, I'm really glad you could join us. Sandra, why should we be shocked by this massive new report coming from the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services?
Well, I think it's the very first time in which evidence coming from all areas, not just ecology, not just economy, not just sociology, converge into a clear and alarming picture that the extent of our domination of the Earth is getting to a really stretching point.
Yes, it almost sounds like humans are driving towards a kind of agricultural planet where unnecessary, in quotes, life forms are driven out. What is so dangerous about that?
It's very dangerous because we actually depend on the diversity of nature in all aspects of our lives, whether we realize it or not. Life on Earth is not just a menu in a cafeteria where you can just focus on the one or two things you fancy that a particular day and everything else will be left alone. Life on Earth is an intricate fabric, and we are one of these many threads interwoven in the fabric. So if we start cutting threads, the whole fabric will unravel. And the analogy goes that if we cut the threads of the fabric that supports and interweaves us, our lifestyle will follow with it, unravel with it. So if you think that we have evolved for millions of years in deep interconnection with the fabric of life, if we start unraveling the fabric of life, our lives wouldn't be the same, physically, psychologically, and spiritually without it. So in a planet without all the apparently unnecessary forms of life, as you put them, in that kind of planet, we would lose our life on Earth as we know it and as enjoy it.
According to the new assessment, how much of the land environment has been severely altered to date by human actions?
About 75%, that's 3/4 of the surface of the land, and about 2/3 of the surface of the oceans have been severely altered. So basically now nature on Earth is human nature.
That's a very frightening thought when we look at the current state of human politics and the way we act towards one another. If we act towards nature in the same way, we're not the government we should elect to run nature, I don't think.
Well, whether we like it or not, we are running the planet now. We humans collectively are running the planet now because the parts of the planet which are completely independent of our doing is really small and getting smaller every day. So we basically need to face it and take full responsibility to be good stewards of the planet.
And that's why they call it the Anthropocene, I suppose. How much of the loss of nature cataloged by your team comes from climate change compared to other factors like agriculture and business?
If one looks at the last 50 years, and if one looks at the whole planet, not particular places, climate change is not the most important direct driver of change. The most direct driver is land use and sea use changed, followed by direct extraction of animals, such as by fishing, or plants, such as by logging. Climate change actually comes third at the global scale. However, its impacts are clearly increasing in the last few years. And all our business as usual scenarios for the next 30 years show very clearly an increasing impact of climate change. And not only that, we have a large number of examples that climate change and the other factors don't act separately, but they actually interact with each other, making each other worse. So, for example, when you add the pressures of climate change, say an increasing temperatures or droughts, to particular areas in where we already have big problems because of land use, and we already have big problems because of pollution, then the problem becomes much worse.
So, Sandra, is it fair to say that even if we did not have a problem with greenhouse gas emissions, the new IPBES report shows that nature would still be severely threatened to the danger point?
Indeed. That's one of the major messages from our report. High greenhouse emissions are just one of the many symptoms of the unprecedented human domination of the planet. Over the past 50 years, our capacity to consume the fabric of life that supports us and our capacity to produce waste has increased massively, as you well pointed out. And all the forms of pollution, including greenhouse gas emissions, are just symptoms. The changes in climate, the extinctions we are seeing are all symptoms of the big global illness, if you want to use a clinical metaphor.
How many species do scientists expect we will lose on our present course of development, and how can you arrive at any number?
Okay, the numbers we arrive are estimation based on the best of biological sciences. There are a number of research groups and a number of dedicated organizations around the world who do that full-time, trying to estimate how many species are on Earth, and on the basis of the threats faced by the species groups that we know well, they estimate what is the total threat. And the estimations, the best ones as showed in our report, are that around 1 million species of animals and plants are threatened. And the rate of extinction is at least tens to hundreds of times faster than has been on average in the past 10 million years. So it's really fast. And if we continue doing business as usual, we are likely to lose most of them very fast. But how many species indeed end up being extinct really depends on us.
You mentioned the thread and the fabric of which we are all part. And I picture a rather dark vision in which, maybe as a last resort, scientists or industrials manage to make a careful ladder of species we depend on right down to the biota in the soil, and then we confidently judge which other species we can go ahead and lose, which are disposable, as we go ahead and take over everything. But I think that's dangerous, maybe even impossible. What are your thoughts?
I think, as I mentioned in the beginning of the conversation, it's a really, really dangerous path that assumes that we knew all the connections that species have with us and all the connections they have with each other. And that's extremely difficult in the fabric. And instead of trying to go to that really, really dangerous path, it would be much easier and much cheaper, certainly, try to keep them, because we can. The fact they are threatened, as I said, doesn't mean they are necessarily doomed. We can make an effort to save them. There are very successful examples. There are a number of species that would be extinct now if it wasn't by the efforts made by conservation organisms in the past few years. There are a number of ungulates. There are a number of birds that have been literally brought back from the brink of extinction. The panda, for example, is such an iconic one that everybody knows him. The panda has been downlisted now thanks to the great efforts to conserve it. So this all shows that when we apply will, when we really take a decision to do something for them, we can bring them back from the brink of extinction. We cannot bring them back from extinction itself, but we can bring them back from the brink and make a difference. And don't just wait for those threats to actually realize themselves in a few years.
In North America and in Europe, there have been tendencies to romanticize indigenous people as the true keepers of nature. But the upcoming report from IPBES shows this is really true in many parts of the world. Please talk to us about that.
Well, one of the novelties of our report is that for the first time, at the scale of global reports, we take a systematic approach to incorporating the knowledge and the issues of indigenous peoples and local communities. And one of the ways in which they enrich the report is we were able to assemble a really comprehensive collection of practices from indigenous peoples and local communities from around the world that actually enhance biodiversity. They have been responsible for the vast majority of the very many locally adapted varieties of animals and plants around the world. I'm talking about here domesticated varieties of crops, domesticated varieties of poultry, of livestock, etc. Indigenous peoples and local communities have been the stewards of all these varieties around the world. They have been able to keep highly diverse traditional landscapes, many of which are so valuable that now are protected under the United Nations World Heritage Landscapes. And overall, it shows that they are doing, nobody's perfect, okay? But they are doing a better than average job as compared to the rest of people in keeping biodiversity.
During a recent visit to New Zealand, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that the political will to fight climate change has faded at the same time as it is getting worse for those feeling its effects. Is that true for biodiversity as well, do you think?
Well, I want to believe it's not true for biodiversity. I would say quite the opposite. I would say we were positively surprised by the huge impact of our report. Of course, we are very proud of the report, and we were hoping for a big impact, but the repercussions we are having around the world completely took us first by surprise. And it means that people are probably for the first time listening that biodiversity is important.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. A new report from the United Nations warns nature is under threat by human activities of all kinds. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Sandra Diaz. What are the big challenges to biodiversity in your own country of Argentina?
Well, in Argentina, as in most of South America, the major threat is basically the fast expansion of industrial agriculture without any safeguards. This is having really, really high impact on biodiversity at all levels and also social impacts on people.
Human expansion on Earth sometimes reminds me of algae in a pond. Algae can expand until it runs out of oxygen, and then it crashes. Is there a crash point for humans when it comes to biodiversity, and are we nearing it?
Well, I think you put it beautifully. Physics and biology clearly show that we cannot keep consuming indefinitely. It's just against the laws of physics, and we cannot keep dumping waste indefinitely either, because it just doesn't go away. So definitely we are on collision course if we keep doing business like this. But again, how far from the brink we stop depends on us, which I think is one of the most powerful messages from our report. We are not necessarily doomed. We can still push the brakes and change course.
Does your assessment report find that the movement from endangered to extinct is speeding up? Is there a time factor in this?
Yes, definitely. There are a number of very solid calculations that shows that the rate of extinction is speeding up fast, but also a number of case studies around the world show that movement in the opposite direction is also possible when we take action. As I mentioned, there are a number of animals that could have been extinct by now if we didn't take proper action. So the pace at which extinction happens is in our hands. That's a very important message, because normally people look at extinctions over geological times, and of course there's nothing that can be done about it. It just happens. But the extinction rates we are looking at now are completely human caused, which is lamentable, but at the same time, it gives us power over that rate. We can slow it down dramatically if we choose to.
Well, I want to expand on something that you've said there, because yes, we can save perhaps the panda or the California condor, but it takes a lot of money and a tremendous effort for each species, and there are so many species at risk. Doesn't it seem like we really need to change our whole lifestyles and our whole consumption of nature to allow all those unseen things? I mean, there are beetles, there are biota in the soil, there's all sorts of things that are threatened that we don't know about and we can't save because we don't know about them. So don't we need a broader approach?
Definitely. We need a broader and much deeper approach. The conservation measures with the panda or the Arabian ibex, etc., are successful, but in a way they are fixes for the symptoms of the illness. So imagine you jump from the roof and you broke every bone in your body and you're bleeding all over, etc. You need to do something about the symptoms. You need your urgent painkillers, things like that. You need a blood transfusion immediately, right? And all the conservation measures protecting this particular species or creating more natural parks, etc., are fixes to deal with the symptoms. Don't take me wrong. They are incredibly important. We need them, right? And we need them because if we wait until we are dealing with the true causes, all these glamorous species will be gone, and we don't want them to be gone. But to actually cure the patient, to fix those broken bones, to stop this bleeding, we need really deep action. And that's why we talk about transformative change, and we're talking about transforming the way we do the economy, transforming the way we do business, basically incorporating biodiversity considerations and biodiversity safeguards and safeguards for the natural world in all the sectors of the economy and our normal, the ways people's lives are run and the ways countries are run. So it's quite a radical change to make, but this is what it takes.
When it comes to land use loss, it seems the greatest threat in South America is meat production, and in Asia it is palm oil production. Surely we don't need to keep expanding either of those products until everything's gone.
Indeed. They are having vastly negative consequences for nature and people. They are the major threat in the whole continent of South America, certainly in many areas in Africa, and certainly in some of the most diverse areas of the world. So while these activities keep expanding, the local population suffers the most of it, but also the whole planet suffers, because this is where most of the species we have today exist. And these activities today are good business because they are not paying the true costs. And many people who benefit from them are in distant places, so they don't realize about the consequences of these choices. Most of the biodiversity, which is humans' common heritage, lies in these areas. So if they go, we all have a less rich, less wonderful world. Many people who use soybean products or palm oil products on their everyday life don't realize the huge suffering that's behind them. I remember watching a documentary about orangutans with a member of my family, and she loved the orangutans and was very excited. And she likes beauty products a lot, and one of them is based on palm oil. So I took the opportunity to say, do you know, your purchase of this particular product are doing to the orangutans you feel so close to and you feel so moved by? And she looked at me in complete amazement. She had no idea. And I'm talking about a highly educated person. These kind of production systems are good business, first because they don't pay the true cost, and also because the consumers that could try different choices actually are not fully aware of the consequences of the apparently harmless choices in their everyday life.
Yes, even the Netherlands was burning palm oil as a power source, as a green power source, and now we know what's happened in Indonesia. It's definitely not that. And at the same time, during our lives, Sandra, we've seen the globalization of the economy, and there's widespread travel, and there's shipping all over the world. And with that comes invasive species. Are we also seeing a kind of globalization of the plant and insect world?
Indeed. It's so widespread that we even have a name for it. Actually, we have two names for it. In plant ecology, we call it biotic homogenization. The fact that because our faring organisms around the world with us, intendedly sometimes as crops and as garden plants, and very often unintendedly, just piggyback on our planes and our ships, etc., we are basically taking plants and animals to places that they would never reach otherwise. And that's why ecological communities all over the world tend to be more similar to each other. The same way that now you go to any shopping center across the world and they all look the same. You don't know in what country of the world you are because they have basically the same stuff. We are doing the same with the biotic world.
Please tell us about the Diversus Network. What is that?
Okay. The Nucleo Diversus is a network of researchers and a think tank of people who do research on the areas of ecology, anthropology, and sociology in an interdisciplinary way, trying to produce primary science, but also trying to review and critically assess what primary science produces and to put it closer to decision makers. We have a strong basis in Latin America, and the hub is in my place. I am the director of Diversus, but we are also reaching internationally to a number of places in which we find researchers which share this taste for interdisciplinary science.
We've heard about the Paris Agreement and the COP meetings about climate change, but very few of my listeners have heard about the Aichi biodiversity targets. Can you briefly tell us what they are and how that relates to the new IPBES report?
Okay. The Aichi targets were targets agreed by the countries who have signed the Convention on Biodiversity, on Biological Diversity. That's an intergovernmental body, so countries get together and agree on common visions and common targets in 10-year periods. So the Aichi targets were established in 2010, so 10 years ago, and as part of the mandate for our IPBES report was that we should be making a critical assessment on whether the countries are likely to achieve the targets by 2020, that is basically tomorrow, right? So the targets are very general. Some of them have to be agreed, for example, increase the number, the surface of protected areas to X percentage of the Earth. Some have to do with curb the damage made by invasive species. Some of them have to be with increase the awareness of biodiversity through education. So they are very general and they cover very different aspects of people's lives, all the way from quick fixes to deep changes. And what we found that of 20 of these targets, they are in total 20, we have done relatively good progress with only four of them. And these four of them are fixes, so to speak. They don't tackle the deep causes of biodiversity deterioration. So, for example, one of them is increase the percentage of the surface of the Earth that is under formal protection, right? In that particular target, we've done well. We have substantially increased the number of protected areas, at least in paper, but biodiversity keeps falling down. And that's why, because while we fix that, and again, I do emphasize that we need protected areas and we need better and more protected areas, but while we keep trying to deal with that symptoms, biodiversity is decreasing sharply in all these areas of the world which are not protected.
At the launch of the IPBES report, you said the battle is not lost yet. Others on the same panel also said we still have time. What still gives you hope that we can save the nature we all depend on?
Well, you know, many people may think that we are hopeless optimists, and maybe we are. But we are optimists because we don't have a choice. Yeah, we are either very fiercely optimist or we don't have a chance. Right? So just keeping business as usual is not an option. And I want to believe that humanity as a whole is smart enough to realize that. And the other thing that I think makes me, at least me personally, optimistic is that a few times before now, a few times in history, there were changes that, until they happened, looked basically impossible or extremely unlikely because they were so much against the grain, because they were so much not business as usual, because they were so much against a very, very large number of vested interests, and yet they happened. There was a tipping point at some point. People just decided it had to happen, and they did happen, and things did get better. And the fact that our report has got so much attention and there are all these environmental movements just cropping up all over the world, people just taking the streets because of nature, taking the streets because of climate, makes me think that we still have hope.
Is there anything else from the new report you would like to communicate to our listeners as we finish up here?
First of all, before I say to the listeners, let me congratulate you for the outstanding quality of your questions. Really insightful. So thank you so much for that. It's not every day that we have the excuse to reply to those kind of questions. And a message to your listeners would be that a life without a connection with the great fabric of life is not the unavoidable cost of development, is not the natural state of things. And this statement is not a philosophical statement, it's a statement based on the best scientific evidence from many different fields of knowledge as reflected in our report. So being nurtured by a fabric of life that is good, healthy, and in good working order is actually not a luxury, it's your birthright. And I would encourage your listeners to fight for this birthright.
We have been speaking with Dr. Sandra Diaz, one of Argentina's leading scientists and a world-recognized expert on biodiversity. We have an executive summary crammed with worrying facts from world scientists. I'll put links to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sandra, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Okay, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When it comes to your food, it's all about moisture in the soil when crops need it. That is changing as the Earth warms, according to new science published in the journal Nature. When we load up the atmosphere with carbon-based power, we get more drought and worse floods. Our guest is the lead author of the new study. Dr. Kate Marvel is with Columbia University and an associate research scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Following her PhD in physics at Cambridge, Kate investigated climate and energy at top research institutions like Stanford, Carnegie, and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Kate is a communicator on various science shows and has a regular column, Hot Planet, in Scientific American. From New York City, Kate Marvel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, please tell us the title of your new paper published in Nature on May 1st, 2019.
The title is 20th Century Hydroclimate Changes Consistent with Human Influence.
What is the basic question your team sought to investigate?
I think the most basic question we wanted to look at was, what does the past tell us about the present and the future? So we are really fortunate to have tree ring-based records of past drought conditions, thousands and thousands of trees. And you can look at the width of their rings, and that tells you something about how dry or how moist the soil was during that year when they were growing. So we have thousands of those records, and they've been aggregated into data sets called drought atlases. And we wanted to see what those drought atlases could tell us about drought in the past and drought now.
I was surprised that you found signals of global climate change so early. I mean, the oil age had barely begun in the year 1900. How could the visible effect of burning coal start so early? Were emissions really that high in the late 1800s?
Emissions weren't that high. So it was actually interesting that we did find this increasingly resemblance. I think the thing to note is that we were looking at trends across a wide swath of the global land area over a really long time period. So it's not that unusual for California to get dry, and it's not that unusual for the Mediterranean to get dry, and it's not unusual for Australia to get dry. But it is unusual for all three regions to show even a very slight drying trend over a really long time. So what we're doing in this paper is we're looking at that big picture, and we're looking over the really long timescales that these tree ring-based reconstructions provide us with.
And I've been thinking about the delay of heat from the time of emissions. It's calculated to be somewhere between 20 and 60 years due to thermal inertia of the oceans. And I wonder if that delay affects the results of your paper at all or changed the picture.
I mean, we're using models that are coupled together. So the models that we're using to understand and compare to the observations have the influence of the ocean. They have the influence of the atmosphere, and they have that coupling between the atmosphere and the ocean. You know, I think we're very careful not to say this is definitely human emissions and this is definitely a really large effect. What we're saying is we see a trend where the observations increasingly resemble what we expect greenhouse gases to do, and they resemble it more than they ever have in the past. And we have tree ring reconstructions that let us estimate the past going back to 1400.
And your paper raises an important new concept for all of us, or at least it was fairly new to me, and that is hydroclimate. What is hydroclimate?
So we would define hydroclimate as all aspects of the climate that affect the hydrological cycle, the cycling of water through the ocean and the atmosphere. What we look at here is something called the Palmer Drought Severity Index, which is a proxy measurement for soil moisture. A lot of people think that drought is just a function of rainfall, right? They think that when it doesn't rain, you get a drought. When it does rain, the drought's over. But drought's affected by other variables as well. Drought can be affected by rising temperatures, changes in wind speed. And so looking at soil moisture or a proxy for soil moisture kind of lets us look at the influence of climate change and anthropogenic emissions on soil moisture.
And we're told that for every 1 degree C of warming, Earth's atmosphere can hold an additional 7% of water vapor. And I'm wondering, where does that extra water into the sky come from? Is some of it sucked out of the land and therefore drought?
Yeah, so evaporation, you're absolutely right that evaporation increases with temperature. I mean, the way I kind of like to think of it is a warmer sky is a thirstier sky. So we definitely expect increases in what we call evaporative demand. Now, the vast majority of the water in the atmosphere comes from the oceans, which from the perspective of the atmosphere are basically a bottomless source of water availability. Over land, we know that it's not a bottomless source. We know that evaporation really, really matters over land, and the ocean doesn't miss a little bit more water that's been evaporated from it, but the land very much does.
And isn't water vapor itself a greenhouse gas? I mean, if there's more water vapor up there as we heat up, is that an instance of warming begetting more warming?
Absolutely. So the water vapor feedback is an example of a feedback that we understand fairly well. We know that warm air holds more water vapor, and we know that you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you warm up the air, it holds more water vapor. Water vapor itself is a greenhouse gas. So that's an instance of something that scientists call, and I think this is the worst terminology we ever could have come up with, we call a positive feedback. Because normal people hear positive feedback and they think that means I'm doing a great job. But when scientists say positive feedback, we mean something that's really destabilizing, something that can add to the warming.
And the strange part of this for me, Kate, is if there's more water in the atmosphere, why would large parts of the world continue to get drier?
Well, I mean, you have a balance, right? We have a balance between rainfall, increases in rainfalls, and we do expect there to be an increase in heavy precipitation events in the future. But at the same time, you do have that increase in evaporative demand. So it's a very complicated picture because you have shifts in rainfall patterns where you expect, on a very large scale, wet areas to get wetter and dry areas to get drier. But you also have shifts in rainfall patterns because we expect the atmospheric circulation is changing as the temperature gradient between the tropics and the poles flattens. So we expect changes in the large-scale motion of air in the atmosphere, and that can really affect where it rains and how much it rains. And again, you know, drought is not just about rainfall. Drought's about temperature and wind speed and other things as well. Something that we don't explicitly address in this paper but is going to be really important going forward is to what extent changes in the land surface can really accelerate or slow down the emergence of these drought signals. As we go forward into the future, we expect changes in the land surface to matter as well. So there have been a lot of really smart scientists. Abby Swan at the University of Washington has been a real leader in this, pointing out that plants are affected by carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We expect the CO2 fertilization effect to make more plants, to lead to greening in some places. We also expect that it makes plants more efficient at using water. So that greater efficiency, which means plants don't dry out the land as much, could be counteracted by the fact that there's more plants. But then again, it's hard to use water efficiently when you're on fire. So we don't know how plants are going to respond to increased heat stress, increased wildfires, and just general rising temperatures. So looking forward into the future, I think there's still a lot of science to be done. There's still a lot of things that we have yet to understand.
Could you tell us a little bit more about those tree ring atlases that help scientists cross-check the climate models against measurements in the real world?
Sure. This is why science is a really collaborative process. I had never worked with tree rings before. I was vaguely aware of their existence, but my collaborator and the co-author on this paper is a real leader in using tree ring-based data sets to understand past climates. So everything I know about tree rings, I learned from him and from reading the references that he pointed me to. So big, big thank you to Ben Cook for this. So this is not really an expert perspective, but tree rings give you an estimate of the climate during their growing season. So, you know, if they are nice and thick, you can infer that the soil was fairly moist, they had lots of room, lots of ability to grow that year. And if they're thin, you can infer that it was a dry year. These drought atlases are the result of thousands and thousands of tree ring measurements collated together to make sure that they're giving a consistent picture. And the great thing about them is anybody is free to download them and play with them. And I think that's just an amazing triumph of kind of scientific openness.
Why was the time from around 1950 to 1975 harder to read for those climate signals than the period before and after?
That's a great question. So we know that in about the 1950s, we start getting an increase in what atmospheric scientists call aerosols. And this can be really confusing because a lot of people think aerosols mean spray cans. But the way we use that word in atmospheric science is we mean basically crud in the atmosphere, as somebody put it to me earlier today. We mean soot, we mean dust, we mean particulates, we mean pollution. And in the 1950s, we see a major increase in the emission of those, you know, kind of what we think of as pollutants. And those have a fairly powerful effect on the climate because they block sunlight. And if you block sunlight and less sun reaches the planet's surface, then that has a cooling effect. Now, we're not 100% sure exactly how strong that cooling effect was because we don't know exactly what the emissions were. We don't know exactly what got emitted where. We don't know what their effect was on clouds, and we don't know to what extent seeding clouds made them more effective at blocking sunlight. But we know the general direction that things should have gone in, and we expect that this increase in aerosol forcing or this increase in aerosol emissions would have a cooling effect and would have kind of a counteracting effect to greenhouse gases.
According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, almost half of all the industrial greenhouse gas pollution has gone into the sky since 1988. Why do you think the hydroclimate signal is still harder to read in the 2000s than it was in the days of early industrialization?
Yeah, that's the big question, and that's something that we really struggled with. What I think is happening is I think there's three explanations, and the answer is probably a combination of all three and probably something else. So first, I would say we're talking about signals emerging from noise, and noise decreases with time. It's a lot more unusual to have something going on for half a century than it is to have it going on for a couple decades. So the first is, I think, the noise is larger. But I think the second possible explanation is the residual role of aerosols. Aerosols have been cleaned up since the 70s, since the Clean Air Act and other environmental legislation in the 70s, but they're not gone. They're still there in the atmosphere, and they could still be having an effect. But the third reason is we know that we have lived through a period of kind of strange climate conditions. From about 1998 to 2013, the climate conditions were characterized by kind of cool anomalies, you know, cool temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean. And we're not 100% sure what caused that. It's definitely consistent with just a mode of natural climate variability. But the upshot of that is that those cool conditions led to formation of low clouds and resulted in warming that was not as great as perhaps it could have been. Whatever was causing that, it seems to be over now. We had really large El Niños in warm waters in the Pacific in 2015 and 2016. And whatever characterized that hiatus, or some disingenuous people called it a pause in global warming, whatever caused that seems to be over now. But that could have had an effect as well.
Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Kate Marvel from Columbia University and the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. You can check out her website at marvelclimate.com. Let's talk about some regional projections from the climate models. Why are the Mediterranean countries in Europe expected to dry out more than other parts of the world?
Well, regional projections are dependent on changes in the atmospheric circulation, you know, that large-scale motion of air and water in the atmosphere, and also the temperature increases. So all of the models basically agree that we should see drying in the Mediterranean. And my co-author, Ben Cook, has done a lot of pioneering research showing that there is a really consistent and robust expectation of drying in the southwestern U.S. and Mexico. So I think we should expect drier conditions in those places. When we will see a unambiguous signal in those particular regions, I would expect we would have to wait a very long time. And that's because internal variability, natural climate variability is large on a regional scale. It's only when you really zoom out and look at that global picture that you see a tractable signal emerging.
And I see that the models are projecting a continued drought in the U.S. Southwest. That is understandable. But I'm wondering, do we know what's going to happen in the key wheat and corn agricultural areas of the U.S. Midwest that help feed America and a lot of the world, really?
That's probably a question for my colleagues here at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who run something called the Agricultural Model Intercomparison Project, where they're really trying to break down the influence of climate change and changes in all of these different variables on crops. So I would defer that question to people with expertise in crop modeling.
Okay, I'll dig that up and see if I can put a link in my blog for it for our listeners. And can you talk about what the projections for the soil moisture or the rainfall in India will be and what challenges may come out of that?
So India is very interesting because in India, the monsoon is of paramount importance. And understanding how climate change will affect the monsoon is still an area of really, really active study. In India, we have really large emission of aerosols, so we expect them to have a pretty large effect. But then we also have a greenhouse gas effect on the monsoon, which is still an area of really active study. We also expect a pretty big impact in South Asia of irrigation, of the fact that we're seeing really large-scale changes to the land surface as a result of large-scale irrigation. We expect that would affect the climate as well. So those projections on that regional scale are still fairly to be studied, I think.
But India might become wetter rather than drier.
It might, depending on how greenhouse gases affect the monsoon.
Right. Okay. Now, Africa is one of the largest continents. It's got a rapidly growing population. Why isn't Africa really covered in this study?
Because there is no drought atlas for Africa.
Okay. And why is that?
It has to do with field data availability and the type of tree and the community's efforts to collect that data. But that's a question for a dendrochronologist to answer.
Well, I hope we'll develop that because I think it's important. Now, I recently spoke with David Keelings from the University of Alabama about super hurricanes, and he told us climate change does not cause hurricanes, but once those great storms are born, then climate change can make them stronger. Is it the same case with drought?
I mean, certainly climate change, droughts would happen without climate change. And any one individual event, it's going to be very, very difficult to say, unless the event is so extreme, it's going to be very difficult to say this particular event would not have occurred without climate change. What you can do is flip the script and say, how did climate change affect this event? How did climate change make this particular event worse? Or how did it make it more likely? And so we expect that as temperatures rise, evaporative demand will increase. We expect as temperatures rise, rainfall patterns will shift. But if you want to sort of if you want to meet the very, very high bar of would this particular event have been extremely unlikely or impossible without climate change, I think you really have to look at long-term trends over really large areas.
I know that scientists reported Australia was actually drier before the arrival of the European settlers, and then those settlers kind of lucked out when they experienced a wet cycle that lasted for a couple of centuries. It was good for agriculture. Now the farming area there is shrinking. So I'm wondering how we know that the drying trends recorded in the tree rings are not also just part of a long hydrological cycle rather than really a result of climate change.
I mean, that's a good question. It kind of gets to using tree rings as a way to estimate variability before the Industrial Revolution. We can say that on a large scale, the things that we see, this increasing resemblance to this fingerprint, that is stronger than it has ever been in the centuries of hydroclimate change that are recorded by tree rings. And we can say that, well, this is consistent with what we expect greenhouse gases to do.
There's an old saying, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and scientists seem to be saying something similar, like the dry get drier and the wet get wetter. What is the underlying process that accentuates this difference as we heat up the atmosphere and the oceans?
Well, we expect, as you noted, warmer air holds more water vapor. And we also expect that water vapor gets there because of increased evaporation, increased evaporative demand from a warming atmosphere. In, I think, 2006, two scientists, Isaac Held and Brian Soden, published a paper that's been very influential, where they basically argued that in the absence of any major changes to anything else, this pattern will result in wet areas getting wetter and dry areas getting drier. Now, we don't expect this to be happening in the absence of other changes, and we think those other changes to things like, you know, the atmospheric dynamics will be significant.
In a press release from Columbia University, you said all the models are projecting that you should see unprecedented drying soon in a lot of places. It almost sounds like there's a delay in that hydroclimate, like pent-up effects that we might see in the next 10 years or so. Is that what you're thinking?
I wouldn't put it as pent-up effects, but I would say a climate signal, even a really strong signal, is always occurring against a backdrop of natural variability. And so climate change detection and attribution is a signal to noise process. It's finding a signal, if it's there, against a backdrop of internal variability, against a backdrop of noise. And that noise is, to some extent, fundamentally unpredictable. You know, I'm not going to be able to tell you if there's going to be a big El Nino in the year 2030. I'm not going to be able to tell you when different modes of different oscillations of the climate system are going to combine in a particular way. So there's always going to be noise inherent in the system. But what the models are saying is that, again, on this really, really large scale and against, you know, over a really, really long term period, we should be able to see something that is significant against that noise backdrop by the middle of this century.
You sound like someone who enjoys science. What are some of the themes that you like to mess around with?
I love my job because I feel like I learn something new every day. I love the fact that no one person can understand everything about the climate system, about this unbelievable planet we live on. So I find myself very often working on problems where I have to work with oceanographers, I have to work with statisticians, I have to work with physicists, I have to work with land surface modelers. And I love that. I love feeling like I get to learn something new all the time.
Are you finding more younger women coming up in science than there were before? It used to be sort of a chorus of male voices on this show, and now it's becoming more and more women scientists, and I love that.
I think the Columbia Earth and Environmental Sciences graduate program this year, all of the admitted students were women. So I think that's great. I think we still have a lot more work to do, and we need to do this, with increasing the diversity, especially the racial diversity of earth sciences.
We've been speaking with Dr. Kate Marvel from Columbia University and the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. She's the lead author of a new paper in the journal Nature and talking about climate change starting as early 1900 showing up in the signals. You can find links to this science discussed in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Kate, thank you so much for getting out here and sharing the science.
Thank you so much.
On my May 1st Radio EcoShock program, we investigated a strange heat phenomenon arising just since 2010. Swiss scientist Martha Vogel told us about multiple heat waves popping up on different continents at the same time. That is new in the instrumental record since the 1800s, and eventually it could show up in two or more major food-producing areas, creating food shortages, famine in some places, riots, or high prices at the grocery store. It just happened again. First, we had strange heat in the Pacific Northwest. The weather went from coldish, winter-like conditions with the wood fire going up to 88 degrees Fahrenheit, 31 degrees C in early May. We had to dig out our summer clothes all of a sudden, and it went on for weeks. We experienced a mini-drought, and the fire season started early. During the same first week of May, temperatures in Europe soared. Heat from Africa across the Mediterranean, again going above 30 degrees C, 80-something Fahrenheit, in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and places north. Even England and Scotland were hot, with people enjoying a trip to the beaches or planting out early. On May 11th, part of the Russian coast on the Arctic Sea reached 84.2 degrees Fahrenheit, a fantastic 28 degrees centigrade in the very far north. The whole Arctic was roasting with wildly abnormal high temperatures, and that is continuing in a band across the Arctic Sea. As a result, the jet stream is distorted, flinging storms from California, where the mountains received May snow, to endless soaking rain in Houston, and a stream of tornadoes and thunderstorms right up the American East. Seen on the global satellite maps, it looks like the cold was pushed out of the Arctic into the so-called temperate zones. So we have strange heat waves in the Northwest, the Mediterranean, and the Arctic at the same time, but a fourth heat wave also appeared on May 11th. Just following the deadly tropical cyclone Fani in the Bay of Bengal, India and Bangladesh were trapped in insufferable heat. As people struggled to recover or find any remaining shelter along the coastal towns and villages, both residents and aid workers sweltered through temperatures near 38 degrees C, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, at the coast, and 40 to 43 degrees C, 104 to 110 Fahrenheit, inland. Humans tend to live in the weather bubble around us. As far as I know, there is no global weather reporter, where people keep track of megatrends like hemispheric disturbances, polar outflows, and multiple concurrent heat waves. Canadian YouTube scientist Paul Beckwith and video blogger Robert Scribbler are about as close as we come to that, so keep track of them. But I think we do need at least one new institution with new media approaches to reflect rapid changes in the climate in this world of ours. I've just received the book The End of Ice from another world watcher, journalist Dar Jamal. He should be on an upcoming Radio EcoShock show. I'm looking forward to that. My thanks to all my email correspondents. I could not do this program without your tips and support. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.